Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio Free Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
The refrigerator full of beer, the cigarette stains on the fingers, the dirty jokes that came from evil hearts, God forgotten. Now I want to tell you, brother, this generation of youth has been raised in an environment like that. I hate to be as negative as I am tonight, but they've been raised in an environment of sexual lust. They've been raised in an environment I forget God. They've been raised in an environment when the book has had no place in national affairs. They've been raised in an environment of sin, of get mine, of live it up, forget God, make all the sexual conquests you can make.
You can't just bury your head in the sand. Politics and religion, superstition go hand in hand.
Now many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
You may remember the C Street scandals of 2009 when Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina hiked on the Appalachian Trail all the way down to Argentina, where he found his mistress. Governor, or our senator, John Ensign of Nevada, had his own affair. And there was a third, a former congressman, Chip Pickering, who actually used this house that was common to all these three men, the C Street house, a townhouse in Capitol Hill, to meet his mistress, a lobbyist. And this religious right organization, the family, helped cover up all these affairs.
Well, you're going through the motions. They don't want to hear a word you say. Got to keep born a faith and keep mediocrity away. Got to fight every day to keep mediocrity away. Got to fight every day to keep mediocrity away.
I think that there is a crisis, totally across our country, obviously, but also within the church. And I suppose all of us, look at reality from our points of view, and mine is in the church. And the things that I see emerging in our country and in the American nation, particularly, there has been a fusion and a partnership established between the neoconservative movement and, of course, the Christian right wing, and I call this Christian fascism. And how it plays out in the church is that, at least in the mainline church, the clergy are simply silent, just silent about what is happening across our country, both the lies that led into the war, the discrepancies, contradictions of the official 9/11 story, the tragedy of this war. Both what it has done to Iraq, what it's doing to our nation, certainly what it's doing to the soldiers, the systematic abuse of prisoners, torture being a policy that has been set from, you know, the White House on down. And the church is silent on these matters. And the abdication of the mainline clergy from speaking what in the Bible is called a prophetic word, not just to power, but an enabling prophetic word to their congregations, because I think, you know, people in the pew need to get out into the street.
We live in a country in which a person cannot get elected president if he openly doubts the existence of heaven and hell. This is truly remarkable. Given that there is no other body of knowledge that we require our political leaders to master, even a hairstylist must pass a licensing exam before plying his trade in the United States. And yet those given the power to make war and national policy, those whose decisions will inevitably affect human life for generations, are not expected to know anything in particular before starting to work. They do not have to be political scientists, economists, or even lawyers.
Thank you very much. God bless you all. Take care.
One day with him. I like this guy. He's from Canada. Came down here and started the Real News Network on the internet. It is fantastic stuff, too. He does, whoa, man. I'm telling you, there's some great talent out there, like Jennifer Lowenstein. Jennifer will be on here at the bottom of the hour, like Dave Lindorf at thiscan'tbehappening.net, like Robert Perry at Consortium News, like Ray McGovern. Boy, we're telling you, we've got some great talent out there, and you got to cultivate it, folks. But I was watching the Real News. I got on the telephone with Paul Jay, and I actually got to speak with the great guy. And I was telling him about the internet and how people out here can't watch the Real News Network a lot because because our internet connection's pretty rough. You know, I got state-of-the-art stuff out here with a satellite uplink and downlink. A lot of people just still got copper wire, you know, with the old telephones. And he said, I understand it's out there. Similar to the Africa, it's probably doing the news out here in Kansas, North Jefferson County, Kansas. It's probably similar to trying to broadcast in remote African villages, you know, villages in Africa. That stuck with me. I thought about that a long time. I still think about it. I think there's something to that in a way because the mentality is still sort of, you know, we're primitive. I'm sort of happy to be a primitive. My wife is not necessarily happy with me being primitive. And I do get sort of savage at times, but she picked me. I didn't really pick her. Well, we'll get on to that. I won't tell you the story after the song. First, this is a good one, classic, Count Basie, and it's sort of fitting for today. The Devil in the Deep Blue Sea, a 1936 classic by Count Basie and his orchestra. I'll get back with you in a little bit.
Thank you. you buy. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Up in, you know,
this propane gas guy, he's got a big cross on top of his operation up here in North Jefferson County. Big, and he turns it on. And they'll put the Star of David up there during Christmas time. I think that's sort of hilarious, too. More on that later when Professor Lowenstein comes on. She'll tell us about this mix, this crazy mix. But he'll have the cross lit up, man. It's like 50, 60, 100 feet in the air. And hey, someone called in. I see the switchboard's got. Well, now, listen, you call in every code 646-716-8652. I got a caller with his hand up. I'll get to it, but I'm going to finish my monologue here. So this guy put in, my buddy put in a wood stove, and this guy's now running around. Now, he's a big Christian Zionist is what I call him. He's a fascist, you know. He's a boss. And he goes around, all my buddies out here, and strings them out on this propane, see. Well, now that my brother's got a wood stove, we don't need that much propane. Well, this guy, you know, he just won't stop. Putting door hangers on, and I said, well, that's, we both were laughing and drinking last night, because they got this free calendar from the same guy. My buddy gave me the calendar, and I've got it hanging here on my bulletin board in front of me in my home studio, and I'm laughing because this guy is now half-ass independent, my buddy, from this corporate vampire who's really, I mean, he uses the religion, the Christian religion, or he'll use the Jewish religion, he'll use any religion to suck that money out of you brothers and sisters. And that's what we've got with Brownback. We've got a whole state government in Kansas that is doing this. Now, I'm going to put this brother on. He's got his hand up. When you call in 646-716-8652, you need to push 1. Well, there's a couple other new callers now. And I notice they're just listening in. That's all right. You can listen in with your cell phone. I'm going to put this brother on. He's got his hand up. You push 1, it puts your hand up on the switchboard, and I know you're wanting to talk. So let's go. This is 913. Let's see what he's got to say, if he wants to say. Did you 913, you're on.
That would be me, right? That would be me, correct?
Yes, welcome to Radio Free Kansas.
Well, this is your old buddy Jim Herman.
Oh, dude. Yeah, there's a news release, folks. I'll help him out here. This is the co-chair of the Kansas Progressive Caucus, Jim Herman. And there's a press release floating around out there. I know it went out to a bunch of news people. You guys got an event starting up there, don't you?
Yeah, that's correct. We're wanting to witness the event of George Bush coming to Kansas City and perhaps hold up a few signs try and get libraries and bookstores to put Bush's book in the true crime section of their stores and libraries. And
President Bush is coming to Kansas City, Missouri, on Monday. I think before Thanksgiving, isn't it?
That's correct. Monday. Mm-hmm. That's this Monday.
Monday, and he'll be at the Unity of the Temple, or what is it? The Temple Unity Village. What is it?
Unity Temple on the Plaza.
Okay.
Unity Temple on the Plaza. It's down. It's on the Plaza. It's on 47th Street. There at the west end of the plaza in Kansas City, and I think we're gathering at 5:30. Bush speaks at 7, so yeah, I think the idea is to, any media that's going to be there is going to be there at the beginning, and just let people that are going in know that we think. They're getting ready to go listen to a war criminal, an unindicted war criminal.
Right. I want to say one short thing. The event, folks, is sponsored by Rainy Day Books out of Fairway, Kansas, which is really just a suburb there, Kansas City, Missouri. Fairway, Kansas, and the Rainy Day Bookstore is sponsoring it. And the woman who runs that operation, it's supposed to be an independent bookstore, is Vivian Jennings. And from what I understand from the Kansas Progressive Caucus press release, they're asking Vivian Jennings to put that his book in the true crime section of her bookstore, as well as other Kansas bookstore sellers. I know people down in Wichita listen to my show regularly. And, you know, you go to your local bookstore, and there's President George Bush's decision points. Ask them politely to put it in the crime section of their book of their bookstalls, because, honestly, this guy is getting away with murder, and literally the murder of thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And he's usurped our Constitution. He's turned the executive branch into similar to what would people would other countries call a king. And I think it's a great idea. And I wanted to clarify that. That'll be this Monday, next Monday, 5:30. Beginning, gathering there at the plaza, at the Unity on the Temple there in the plaza of Kansas City, Missouri. Go down there and send a message to Vivian Jennings, Rainy Day Books, and let her know that, give her the truth. And sure. You wanted to talk about something else, Brother Jim?
This morning I was at the Wyandotte County Democratic Third Saturday Breakfast. Very well attended. Probably close to, there's probably 80 to 100 people attended. To hear our Kansas City, Kansas Mayor Joe Reardon speak about all the success that's been going on in Wyandotte County. Wyandotte County has had over $280 million of permitted construction in 2010 so far. And probably expect to go even more next year. In the middle of this recession, when everybody else is cutting back, we're building in Wyandotte County, and Wyandotte County is a heavily Democratic county. 68%, 2/3 of the registered voters and 2/3 of the voters in Wyandotte County are Democrats. You know, Wyandotte County is the only county in the state of Kansas that returned all our Democrats to the state house. We just want to start driving the narrative that a democratic government that is democratically elected of Democrats, a government that cares about equity and equality can be successful at bringing business in and driving economic growth without having to be the budget cutting plutocrats that the state is being governed by. The state's going to get the government they deserve, The Republicans are in a precarious position now because now they have to govern, and they suck at that. So it's, you know, the state of Kansas is going to get the government they deserve, and we need to drive the narrative that Wyandotte County has the government they deserve, and it's really paying dividends. It's really paying off. It's crime is at a 25-year low in Wyandotte County. Wages are the wages of someone working in Kansas City, Kansas, are second only to Johnson County in the state of Kansas. So it was really interesting the information that Joe Reardon presented, and we're going to try and he has been videotaped. The community college is working on an edited version of his presentation that we'll get up on YouTube and we'll get it distributed, and you can send that out to your callers, your listeners. So
okay, and for information, now I got, I think, Professor Lowenstein on my guest featured guest for day on the phone here, and I'm going to need to. I'm sorry, Jim. I'm going to have to cut you off here in a little bit.
Oh, yeah, sure.
How do you get a hold of the Kansas Progressive Caucus? How can we do that on the net?
KansasProgressives.org. And if you go to
Kansas,
kansasprogressives.org, and there's information on there how to get a hold of us, how to contact the co-chairs at kansasprogressives.org. We'll go to me and Serena Hine, our female co-chair. Progressive Caucus is the only caucus in the state that has gender balance in the chairs of the caucus.
That's true.
Everybody else just has one chair, which
right. Yeah, Serena Hine and Jim Herman are two great people. I'm a proud member of the Kansas Progressive Caucus too. But I want to remind listeners, 5:30 at the Unity at the Plaza, the big plaza down there at Kansas, Missouri. They're assembling at 5:30 Monday evening to politely welcome George Bush into the community, but at the same time remind the sponsor, Rainy Day Books, Vivian Jennings, President Vivian Jennings of Rainy Day Books, brought him into town to put his book in the crime section. And thank you, Jim Herman.
And thank you, Michael, for all you do, and thanks for rebel rousing.
Thank you very much. And I think we have on the phone, I think we're ready. I think we've got our featured guest, Jennifer Lowenstein. The microphone is open, Professor.
Oh, hello.
It's you.
It's
608.
Me.
608. All right. Well, that's easy as it gets, sister.
How's that?
Yes.
Nice to be on.
Yes, welcome to Radio Free Kansas. I am really happy to have you on.
I've been getting your emails for a long time. It's been exciting just to read them.
Well, I'm not the best writer, but I do try. And Professor Lowenstein, is that okay to call you that, Lowenstein?
Oh, well, the Germans say Lowenstein, and people here say Lowenstein, and I don't really care which one you call me.
Well, Mikey Weinstein, I've got to get this straight, he corrected me on that. He says it's Weinstein. He runs military, the religious freedom
Oh, well, I can tell him. Sorry, go ahead.
No, he reminds me of that, and I always get it confused. But so, Professor Lowenstein.
If you're in Germany, you say Stein, and if you're in this country, everyone says Steen. But in German, if you have EI, then you always say I. And if you have IE, you always say E.
I see.
Grammar lesson number one.
I love it.
How's that
love
for
it.
Starting out your show?
It's wonderful, and I like smart people. I think smart people are really underappreciated out here in Kansas, and that's one of the big problems.
Hey, I want you to know something. I was born in Wichita, Kansas.
Are you kidding me? I didn't know that.
I am not kidding you. Wichita, Kansas, 1566 Yale Boulevard in 1961. How do you like that?
I love it. That makes you a native, sister.
Yeah, I'm telling
you, I
haven't been back in ages, but, you know, one of these days.
Yeah, one of these days maybe we'll have you come down here and talk to us villagers out here in North Jefferson County. It'd be great.
I don't know what you think Madison is. It's not much more than a village with a big university in it.
It has a big reputation, I'll tell you that. It has a great reputation with people I know, that's for sure. Madison, very similar to Lawrence at the University of Kansas. People get upset. The right-wing media echo chambers on the AM radio stations out here, they call it the People's Republic of Lawrence. They get
That is funny because Madison is always or has often been referred to as the People's Republic of Madison. So you have something
funny
in common.
Yes, and I'm 33 miles north. My wife goes down and works down there. She's a assistant professor at Times and in the KU School of Medicine for Public Health. So, you know, it's a great thing. And she picked me, as I said earlier. She picked me, and I'm always running behind her, and I get sort of jealous or mad sometimes about being in her shadow. I like great women. And you're one of them, Jennifer. I read your stuff. I want to be a feminist, but, you know, I have to constantly, day-to-day, fight my male hierarchical chauvinism. Out here, people out here, they beat their wives and beat their kids, and they go to church, and And they
well,
think
I
they're on the right
you that,
side of the Lord.
But they do that in Wisconsin, too.
Well, it's something wrong there.
There's
like
a lot more than wrong with Kansas, believe me.
I like fire. Well, what I if I give my listeners in there, the switchboard is getting a little busy here, but there is something to the power of a smart woman. It's really important. I think we need to more and more, like John Lennon, scathingly criticized our current paradigm of society. You know, women are not niggers of the world. You know, we need to turn that over, because that's John Lennon talking in a very controversial song of his.
Oh, that's
and
funny.
I
didn't know that.
Yeah, women are the niggers of the world. He was making fun of it, of course. But, you know, and so I've always thought of that when I think of good women, great women, strong women, smart women, like my wife and you. And you, I read my counterpart.
Well, yeah,
time, I haven't
talked
man.
To you long enough yet to know if I'm smart. Maybe,
no,
maybe,
I read your stuff. I read your stuff, Jennifer. And it's just like, go to Counterpunch and just type in her name, listeners, and you'll get a bunch of great stuff. And, you know, and another reason I like you, Professor Lowenstein or Steen, is because the people
yeah.
I don't like David Horowitz and them, I've been doing a little background, you know. I'm a detective by formal training, former.
That's good.
And those people hate you, who I call the Christian Zionists.
Well, that's always
crazy.
That's good. I mean, you know, you're doing something right
you.
When you're hated that much.
That's right. That's right. I thought that was so when I was hearing that, I thought, this is great. I didn't realize that you really must have hit their buttons, man. I'll bet you Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck will never have you on their show.
Well, thank
not brave
heavens. Enough. Yeah. I wouldn't want to. I have to admit, I wouldn't want to go on their show. But, you know, there is a part of me that loves to give peace of my mind to people who I think are corroding our society even more than it has already been corroded.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do have ideals, and I may be naive in some ways because I like to think there's still hope. But sometimes when I look
mm-hmm.
around me, I get pretty bleak. And listening
well,
to those guys doesn't help.
I think you're descriptive on the way you write and use our language is what is most endearing about what you do. And you have some unique qualifications. I'm looking here at some of your background on the net. It says areas of expertise. This is from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You know, your Middle East Studies Program Associate Director, and you've really done a lot of work for listeners who don't know about Jennifer's work, is Israeli-Palestinian conflict, rise of the Islamic politics in Lebanon, occupied Palestinian territories, Jordan, Egypt, and Syria, Hezbollah and Hamas, and oil politics and colonialism in modern Middle East, the Goldstone Report, which is really, you know, sort of a mystery to me and many of my listeners.
Mm-hmm.
We might dwell a little bit on what is the Goldstone Report. And you've been all kinds of achieved. Global Citizen Award, Dane County United Nations Association, 2009, member of the first Rachel Corrie, another unfortunate, powerful woman who has died, Rachel Corrie. Folks, Professor Jennifer is a member of the first Rachel Corrie Foundation delegation to the Gaza Strip in the Middle East, in Israel, on September 2009. That's another strong woman. And
participant
in United. Yes, and there is a lot to say about that. Participant in United Nations 11th Human Rights, board member Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, author essay Inside Lebanon, Journey to a Shattered Land in the Monthly Review Press, 2007. It goes on and on. Professor Jennifer, you know,
hey,
I'm...
You're inflating my head. You better stop.
Well, then why don't you tell us a little bit about what you think what's going right and wrong about the policies, U.S. foreign policy in Israel and the Middle East.
There is nothing going right about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. But because I don't like to sound so negative when I talk on the radio or anywhere else, I always tell people that there are some things that are going right, and that is that there are more and more people in this country who are starting to say, wait a minute, what on earth are we doing? And I've seen this because I've been an activist for 31 years. And, you know, when I started out as a very young, you know, 19-year-old, I used to see only a very small group of people who ever got involved in Middle East groups, especially on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And over time, I have to say that with the first Gulf War in 1991 and the sanctions regime that followed that, when we had sanctions on Iraq that killed over 500,000 children, it was in the mid-90s that I started to see a real change in the makeup of activist groups on the Middle East, where people who were not just quote-unquote radical Jews or Arab Americans or students from the Middle East, there were so-called average Americans starting to come to these groups and to dialogue with people and talk with people. And since then, especially since the second Iraq war in 2003, I have noticed a dramatic change again in the makeup of these groups, so that now the minorities in the groups are Arab American students and radical Jews. And I think that's terrific, because it means more people here are figuring out that we are really screwing up over there. And by screwing up over there, we are costing this nation more than we can even begin to afford to cost this nation in every respect: health care, education, daycare, jobs, infrastructure construction, the kind of money that we are pouring into Afghanistan and Iraq and Israel and to some of our puppet states like Egypt and Jordan. If people understood how much we are spending to prop up some of the most despicable regimes, they'd start to be upset too. So sometimes I just think it's a matter of getting the knowledge out.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing that, and I'm really happy to have you here doing it here in Kansas for us. But, you know, it's sort of hard to wrap your head around this thing, but it's not just, I think it's $3 to $5 billion a year our taxpayer dollars go to doing various things for the militarized state of Israel. Could you help us out on a little bit of that? How much foreign aid? And foreign aid is not a big part of our budget, but then you start thinking about all the sweetheart deals with the corporate plutocrats, the arms dealers,
the arms companies. Listen, here's something for people to think about. Israel,
let me say one thing out. One more. I want to help you. I want to help us understand.
Well,
it's not just military, but it's also military aid to Egypt and other countries.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. And first of all, Israel gets between $3 and $5 billion every year, free. It's not a loan. It is the country that receives more money from the U.S. than any other country in the world. The second largest recipient used to be Egypt. I think it may now be Colombia, and Egypt may be third. Saudi Arabia just received $60 billion in military sales. We just sold
60? I didn't know it was that big.
$60 billion in military hardware sales to Saudi Arabia, and they don't need it. They don't need it. But when I read that, what was even more disturbing was to realize that that is but the tip of the iceberg, because the total amount of sales this year to Saudi Arabia, the Gulf countries, and countries like Egypt is $465 billion. Now, what we are doing essentially is arming to the teeth nations that are already overarmed, where there is a great deal of instability, thanks to a large part to the policies of the United States. And when you think about the potential consequences of using these weapons, or worse, of these weapons getting into the hands of people who you don't want to really think about. That's not impossible. You know, I mean, first of all, I don't like the weapons in the hands of the current governments over there, because the current governments are dictatorships, and their human rights records are abysmal. They are repressive governments that oppress their own people. Saudi Arabia is certainly one of the most repressive governments in the whole world. And you know, there's no reason for us to think that eventually the people of Arabia are not going to try to overthrow the Saudi regime. In fact, I wish they would. But unfortunately, all too often in when there are military coups, people with even more extremist views end up getting into power, and that becomes an even bigger problem. And you get... what you get are groups like Al-Qaeda that we basically created. And we created it by arming the Arab Afghans and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. And when certain people in the State Department and in the National Security Council here warned that, you know, this could have a real blowback effect on us, we ignored it. You know, when 9/11 happened, you know, you had a whole bunch of people, probably about 350 million people, I don't know how many are in this country, watching glued to their televisions trying to figure out what happened.
Mm-hmm,
and
that's true.
Why wasn't that? We should know why that happened. We should know, because it should be taught in our schools how poorly our foreign policy in the Middle East has been directed, how unwisely it's been conducted for the last 65 years or more, since the U.S. made a pact with Saudi Arabia, basically, to control its oil. And, you know, there's just so much people don't understand, and it's not that complicated. People tell me they don't understand it, it's much too complex, you know, it's way above their heads, and that's what a lot of people want
you
to believe.
Well, what I want to hear is, and what you just told us, are people in Kansas and leaders of the Kansas Democratic Party who just got their, excuse me, Professor Jennifer, got their asses kicked. I know some of them listen, some big guys listen out here in Kansas from Radio Free Kansas, and no one ever put it in dollars and cents. $465 billion poured
into a region that is already armed to the teeth. I mean, these are not countries that need more military weapons, state-of-the-art weapons. They don't need it. Iran is not a military threat. Nobody will tell you on CNN or Fox News that Iran is not a military threat to the United States or to Israel. Nobody will tell you that. Because if they tell you that, then they have to make up a whole big different story for why we're going after Iran.
I want to remind my listeners, folks, 53 cents of every tax dollar you pay the federal government goes to the Pentagon, and that's it, to the Department of Defense, and that is in addition, now we've learned from Jennifer, $465 billion, in addition to the $465 billion in aid, or whatever you want to call it.
In military hardware sales, arms sales, to these regions. And you know what that does? It gives our arms corporations huge profits. It allows them to continue making huge profits off the backs of the people in this country who work for those factories, for those companies like Boeing and Rayovac and Lockheed Martin, or what was Lockheed Martin. You know, these it's the gun belt. You know, when you want to find out who's profiting from this, you just go to the aerospace industries and the weapons manufacturers, the companies making F-16 fighter jets. They're profiting off a system that has become increasingly militarized. Our economy is based on the military. on military arms sales, on military hardware, on military manufacturing.
I was watching the Real News Network. A recent hot one came up with Professor Noam Chomsky, and I was really struck by he said he keeps bringing up these polls that people like me and I'm with him on this because I watch this stuff. But a lot of people out here would much rather see all this money towards what you were talking about, daycare. Our hospitals are being cut back out here. Our public health services are being cut. Our public schools.
Chomsky showed in one of his books, I believe it's called Failed States, and it's a marvelous book, and he talks about how in every one of the past something like 6 or 7 elections, the top concern of Americans was health care, was getting universal health care. It doesn't even get touched by the candidates. Nobody even considers it. This is socialists trying to take over the United States. Is England a socialist nation? Is Germany a socialist nation? Is Canada a socialist nation? I mean, I've been in countries where there's universal health care, and it's not perfect, but at least if your child is sick, you can take him or her to the doctor, and you don't have to pay for it.
Well, you know, he said in this latest, it's about his analysis with Paul Jay on the Real News, about Professor Chomsky talked about how I'm going to use my words, he's much more polite. The idiocy, the insanity of buying solar panels from China and mass transit systems from Spain when we don't have any of this. And he says it's basically the corporate plutocrats are hijacking even the basic things that we should have here in this country, and they're doing it by the most undemocratic means. And here we've got $465 billion in military aid to the Middle East. We got over almost $1 trillion Pentagon Department of Defense budget every year, almost now.
Mm-hmm.
And here these corporate plutocrats are going off to China to bring solar panels here that we could be building ourselves and high-speed rail systems from Spain.
Exported all of our manufacturing to other countries except for manufacturing in the arms industry? Why? And even that, some of that has been exported. Why is all of our manufacturing for these things exported abroad? Partly because of cheap labor. But the fact is we're a service-based economy now, and underlying our economy is a huge, gigantic military machine that is profiting off the backs of the people working in this country and also abroad. And what are they doing? You know, there's a quote, and I'm trying to remember who said it. I think it might have been Einstein, something about people who arm and prepare for war get war. Do people listening on your radio today realize that we have nuclear submarine battalions are at the island, on the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, that we have an arms buildup going on there that could destroy, obliterate Iran in a matter of hours? Do they understand why do we keep putting more arms there? Why do we have nuclear submarines? Why do we have USS John C. Stennis or whatever it's called in the Persian Gulf? What is the point of that? We are arming for war every single day, and the intensification of that arming is increasing, and the profits for these military industries are increasing at the expense of people in this country who can't send their kids to school, who can't get health care when they need it, who can't get dental care, to say the very least, who can't get daycare for their children, who can't find jobs because the jobs have been exported overseas so that the companies don't have to give their workers benefits. I don't think people understand how this country works, how its economy sustains itself, because if they did, there would be so much outcry. There would be so much anger at the government. You know, give me back the money I paid you in taxes so I can afford to go to the doctor, damn it.
Right.
It's just, it's obscene.
It's really a strange time to be alive here in America, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for me, it's just, I mean, I'm 55 and I've never seen it. You know, I came of age I had the last draft number. I always joke with my, you know, during the Vietnam War, the
mm-hmm.
last year of the draft, I had 50, my draft number was 54 and I was sweating bullets. But I mean,
it's the same as my husband.
And I was like going, my goodness. And then after that, it was, it was Vietnam. Then we had the Reagan years come in. It was Grenada.
You know what's scary?
Yeah.
You know, the draft that was going on in the 60s and 70s for Vietnam, in a way, what had a positive, had a silver lining, and that was that it mobilized people here to protest.
Right.
And in some ways,
I was in a little town called Leroy, Kansas, and I was, I became sort of what they called a hippie. I became a hippie largely based on what I was watching on the television about SDS and with the struggle of the civil rights movement and the Black Panthers. I became, and I was watching it through a static-filled black and white television and,
mm-hmm.
and listening to rock and roll music late at night, and I became, you know, student council president and led the first walkout in our high school, probably the only walkout
and
in high school's history.
And you know what? The media
over the Cambodian invasion, Jennifer.
Oh,
and
my God.
I thought
how much that was hushed up? Do you know what Henry Kissinger said about the invasion of Laos? He said when it came to targeting people and things on the ground, he said, anything that moves, meaning any aircraft that moves on anything that walks, anything that moves on the ground, anything that flies on anything that moves, he, in other words, basically called for genocide in Laos. And today he's sitting in his comfortable little
mm-hmm.
mansion out in the East Coast, and rather than behind bars in The Hague. You know,
mm-hmm.
but the media learned... The media learned through Vietnam that one way to silence people is not to show these images on television anymore, not to tell them about the protests happening. The other thing they learned is not to photograph people, dead people coming back in coffins who've been blown apart by improvised explosive devices in Iraq and Afghanistan and God knows
mm-hmm.
where else. We don't show it, so there's no mobilization. They also learned... Our great leadership learned that we can't have a draft that's up front because too many people will protest. So instead what we have is a poverty draft. You get people who can't live unless they join the military to support their families. That's how they can afford to go to school. That's how they can afford to have... It's so sickening.
It's pretty wild when I see these young guys who don't like, they're not really even big religious Republicans or anything like that. They're raising those kind of families, but I see them being pushed almost, you know, really pushed into a corner financially where
I
they
feel
can't
sorry
afford,
for
can't
people
afford.
Like that. I don't hold it against them. They are the tools and the puppets of our, not even the puppets, they are the pawns of our government. Our government and our military uses people. They are sacrificing human beings on the altar of their military profits. And if more people understood that, there would be a lot of outrage in this country.
Well, those are my friends out here, and they're driving 120 miles a day round trip to keep what jobs they have, to keep their families, one or two or three children together. And they all come from proud Republican
And Israel is getting $5 billion
a
year.
Really, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know,
when they hear
the
this, start,
Where is the anger? Where is mobilized anger in Kansas, in Oklahoma, in Nebraska, in Texas, in New Mexico? I mean, where, all over the nation, where is the anger that we are pouring so many trillions of dollars into murdering civilians? And we can't give our own people jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a crime. It's a crime against humanity.
You know, could you tell us a little bit about, I guess you lived in Gaza, which is, and tell us where Gaza is. And,
the Gaza Strip
is,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and tell us about your experiences there. Because I, you know, some, now I like smart people like you and my wife and Chomsky. But, you know, there's this, I don't know what the right word for dichotomy or strange contradiction, where many of us people who live in the villages by choice and are clinging to our, I own 10 acres, clinging to our little places to stay out here because we like where we live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is there any similarity to that kind of village life in Gaza left? And what would it be like, you know, if we were people like us out here living in Gaza? Tell us, I mean, because I don't understand the geographics exactly.
The Gaza Strip is about 25 miles long and 5 miles
mm-hmm.
wide. It is the single most densely populated piece of earth on the planet. There are 1.5 million people living in that tiny strip of land, and approximately 3 kilometers of it all around the periphery, the border, is a military zone that Israelis have blocked off so that people who once could farm can't farm because they can't go near the border. It is a giant prison because if you live in Gaza, you can't leave. And if you get out for some reason, if there is enough international pressure, which is the only way people get out, or if their political somebodies, if the Israelis grant them permits to get out, they often can't get back in. But the fact of the matter is, the overwhelming majority of the people of Gaza are prisoners. They can't leave and they can't return. And they can't rebuild their homes after they're bombed because the Israelis have put the Gaza Strip under siege. And so the materials that are necessary to reconstruct buildings are banned from entering the Gaza Strip. It's not just, it gets a lot worse because the Gaza Strip doesn't have electricity, enough electricity for most people to have 24 hours solid a day. There are approximately 12-hour blackouts across the strip in every city and town. The Gaza Strip, first of all, is about 9/10 refugees, people who used to live or whose families used to live in the land of Israel but who were expelled in 1948. They're not allowed to return to their land. They will never be allowed to return to their land under the current administrations we've got in power. They are accused of being terrorists and being vicious, vile, subhuman people. They don't have an army. You know, there's no tanks and F-16s, phosphorus bombs and rockets of the kind that the Israelis use in the Gaza Strip. I mean, come on. People want to play that up in the media when there's a rocket fired across the border from Gaza into Israel. I don't support that any more than I support the other way around. But we have to look at something called asymmetrical warfare. We're talking about the fourth largest or the fourth most powerful military on earth, that's Israel, going up against 1.5 million poverty-stricken, primarily children, because more than 50% of the population of Gaza is under the age of 18. So when Gaza is bombed and it's very densely crowded, most of the people who die are civilians. The people who can fight back are fighting back with outdated weapons that don't do a damn thing. They have no real formal training. I'm not justifying violence on their side. I think it's a mistake, and I think you'll see if you look at the news that the firing of rockets has mostly been stopped except by a few groups that don't heed the call of their own government. And, you know, even we, the government of the United States can't control militias in Michigan that get out of
right.
I mean, you know, you can't blame the whole country for, or you can't blame Washington, D.C. for what a group of people in Michigan might do. So it's really not appropriate to go strike the Gaza Strip with, drone strikes, Black Hawk or helicopter gunship strikes, targeted assassinations, F-16 bombs that fall on crowded areas and kill mostly civilians. That's not appropriate to do. That's asymmetrical warfare. You don't have, that's, you know, it's Godzilla stepping on Bambi. That's
mm-hmm.
the reality of it.
Well, for better or worse, people out, my buddies out here in the Blue Barn Posse, that's what we call ourselves, you know, we watch the some of those videotapes of those so-called missiles being shot
mm-hmm.
into Israel during the invasion of Lebanon. And, well, that was used as an excuse to invade Lebanon, as well as holding a couple Israeli soldiers hostage, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember that, and some of my buddies, we were watching TV. One of them had satellite cable, and we were watching CNN. And we noted that, you know, we could probably make the same thing. They just use propane tanks.
They're
used for barbecue. We were going,
yeah.
Look, these guys made them out of barbecue grill tanks, you know,
yeah,
to get tanks we used to. They're very primitive, and we were sort of laughing. We were like going, well, in a sick way. We were laughing. It's like, well, you know, we could do that. But, you know, what's funny is look, what's sick.
It's like having a kid throw a snowball at a guy with a tank. It really is. Put a rock in a snowball, even, and throw the snowball at a guy in a tank. And then the tank comes in and rolls over you because you dared to object to the fact that you've been put in prison and all of your human rights have been taken away.
Well, actually, what they do is roll over Peachy and Sandra and the old folks that are out here in our villages if we did anything crazy like that. And that's what we summed up. If we didn't made rockets out of propane tanks from our barbecue grills, these people would come in and they'd just roll over the old people that, you know, and that's what we, and that was sort of that was a big point for my buddies and I to watch that. And we were thinking, you know, because we get mad, you know, and we think about that. And I thought, well, you know, that's who's suffering over there. Are the young, the children, and the women, and the old folks. That's who enormously, it's, you know what, Jennifer?
That was the overwhelming majority of deaths in Operation Cast Lead were civilians. And I just have to say one other thing, because most people just don't understand this.
Right.
The leadership of Gaza was holding to a ceasefire. It was holding to it religiously. It had not broken the ceasefire. The ceasefire was broken by the Israelis on November 4th, 2008, Election Day, when America would be paying attention elsewhere. That's when
wow.
the ceasefire was broken. But it was because of that Israeli breaking of the ceasefire that the Israelis used that as an excuse. That was one of their excuses for going back into Gaza and destroying what was left of its infrastructure. There's nothing there. You go to Gaza and you walk around and you think, oh, my God, this looks like a place
mm-hmm.
that's been hit by some kind of nuclear apocalypse. The
mm-hmm.
rubble is still in the streets. There's nothing to remove the rubble with. You know,
sort of like
people are living in tents.
It's like Haiti, you know, where except instead of an earthquake, it's the corporate version of the Department of Defense of the United States just pouring all this armament and turning their villages into rubble and then massacring the people that even stand up in the streets against them. And
well,
it's just,
there are so many accounts of families and children who were killed deliberately by the Israeli military during Operation Cast Lead, that if the public ever got a hold of the Goldstone Report, which they can do very easily and read it, they wouldn't.
Help
they wouldn't
us out.
Sleep
where can
at
we get
night.
It first?
They wouldn't.
Where
you
can
go
get
to
it
the, go to Google and Google Goldstone Report and read it. It's not difficult to read at all. And it chronicles one war crime after another. And it chronicles
who's
both sides.
Who's Goldstone, Professor Jennifer?
He was, I believe, and I always get this wrong, I think he was a South African justice. His name is Richard Goldstone. He was also a board member at Hebrew University. He is Jewish, and he is Zionist. And he took a team of people in with him to the Gaza Strip to evaluate what happened during Operation Cast Lead and came out with a report that was so damning of the Israelis that they practically stripped him of his citizenship.
Tell me he was biased.
You know, here is a Jewish Zionist guy going into the Gaza Strip after Operation Cast Lead who wrote out, you know, as I said, Google the Goldstone Report and read it. The atrocities committed by the Israeli army are so horrifying that they give you nightmares. It's all there for the public to read.
Well, we don't know until we have people like you come on and tell us. And I'll tell you something. I was just listening. I have to do this. I don't like it, but I do it because I can't criticize them unless I hear what they're up to.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Hannity was calling it the flotilla. Now, we'll have to back up and talk about what this flotilla thing with these ships coming. He called it an invasion. He called this boat. And could you? What was this thing called, the Freedom Flotilla? And was it? Could you call it an invasion, like Normandy Beach in World War II, which we're all familiar with?
Well, if you're Sean Hannity and you have that kind of imagination, I suppose you could. It was a flotilla of, I think, about 6 or 7 ships, all of which had passed through customs, NATO-controlled customs, I should add, so that it was well known that there were no weapons aboard those ships, none. Those ships were carrying humanitarian aid, tons of humanitarian aid, food, clothing, supplies, household supplies. They were carrying all of this material to Gaza to try to break the blockade because all of these goods and materials are kept out of the Gaza Strip. So a lot of people got together, not for the first time, and decided they were going to break the blockade through by sailing a flotilla of ships into the port at Gaza and delivering the humanitarian aid. Now, as I said, the ships were inspected thoroughly, not only by the countries where they left from, but by NATO customs. Turkey is a NATO power. Greece is a NATO power. There is nobody who can stand up and say those ships were armed and full of terrorists. They weren't. The United States and Israel knew that they had the lists of names of the people aboard the ships.
The reason they
were stopped in international waters, which is a violation of international law, they were boarded by Israeli naval commando units. People were executed in cold blood by Israeli soldiers, bullets to the head. I have a friend who watched it happen. And the ships were commandeered, towed to the port of Ashdod in Israel. Everyone who was aboard the ships was put in prison, forced to sign papers saying that they would never return. And this was called an invasion? An invasion of humanitarian supplies to the Gaza Strip? This was a threat to Israel? And not only that, you know, when a NATO ship is attacked, when a NATO nation is attacked on the high seas, as these ships, which were part of the flotilla, were, it is the responsibility of other NATO powers to come to the aid of those people and those ships. And the United States sat back and did nothing. The reason, of course, is because we support Israel, and we don't want the siege of Gaza broken. They can keep it up until everybody in Gaza dies. That's how much they care about the people living there. And what's behind it all? Land and power. Israel is an offshore United States military base. and it uses and tests its weapons out on the Palestinian people locked up in their cantons in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Well, you know, this conflicts with a thing I learned from a former CIA senior analyst, Ray McGovern, because in a way, maybe it doesn't, but he reminded me a couple shows back, last month, I think, that we don't have a, we don't have some sort of a treaty with Israel that we have. He said we don't have a treaty with them. We don't have a formal treaty.
No.
Why? And he was more or less saying, why should we honor, you know, what we're doing there? And you
well,
know, he,
the ship
you know,
that was
he has,
attacked
he has,
was
he
Turkish.
He has been attacked.
And
well,
Turkey is
point.
A NATO member, and the United States is a NATO member. So it was up to the United States to go to the defense of its co-NATO
right.
power, Turkey, and it did nothing. Israel
they,
is
they
not
even...
a NATO nation. That's true. Israel is nevertheless, as I said, the fourth most powerful military country on Earth. And it
which
gets,
we created.
It is essentially, it is an offshore. It is a country the size of about Massachusetts that is a gigantic military base.
Well,
that's why it is strategically useful to the United States.
You got me. I'm having a highball right now thinking about this.
That's what Israel is. Noam Chomsky calls it that, by the way. He calls Israel an offshore U.S. military base. That's where we transport our arms. That's where we train people. That's where they develop their own biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons. They test them out on Palestinians every time a pipe bomb comes across the border. They have no ability to target anybody. And, you know, it's a strategic asset for us because it makes launching any kind of war on Iran, on Iraq, on any other country in the Middle East very convenient. The United States and the Israelis are hand in hand. They're arm in arm. They're right next to each other. Israel is just an extension of our power. And when we can't sell legally, when we legally cannot sell military arms to other nations for various reasons, put down in international law, you know what we do? We get the Israelis to do it for us. That was part of the Iran-Contra scandal back in the 1980s.
Well, address this. You know, many of these people out here, not many, well, a few, the vocal minority on hate talk radio and their supporters who listen to it, think President Obama is, first off, a Muslim. And that's what they call him, and that that you know he's selling out everything you know to Indonesia or something. It's just crazy stuff.
They are
but,
buying
I mean, he's
into.
Not, he's not really doing. You can address this. But I just want to make this short statement. Being the devil's advocate, and I don't like to do this, but it's important that I try to represent the people out here a little bit, as much as I disagree with the crazy ones. You know, but they say he's a half breed Muslim. That's one of the favorite things. And, of course, he's African-American, black, you know, and that's another thing. And then and we're not even going to deal with the socialism thing. We already talked about that. But the thing is they are like spy bots for the Murdoch Fox News machine. They watch it, listen to it. Local radio stations are all – they got Glenn Beck in the morning at 8 o'clock to 11 in the morning, the blowtorch, the big AM radio stations that they listen to on their tractors and their pickup trucks are indoctrinating, literally just telling these people out here that this guy is going to sell them out. And I don't even think they understand that. I don't think Obama is doing half of what they're afraid he's doing. I think he's actually doing the opposite. He's probably helping him out in a way. Could you help me out on that, Obama?
Yeah. I'm afraid you're right. First of all, I think people buying into the kind of propaganda you're talking about, that he's a Muslim, that he's a socialist, the people putting out that propaganda, I have to hand it to them, they are very successful PR people.
Yeah.
Because people who don't know any better buy into it. And they buy into it without looking into the records into the documentary record. What is Obama really doing? Obama has taken American civil liberties and done worse things to human rights in this country, civil liberties in this country, than Bush. He's taken them a step further. He has gone further than the Bush administration in appeasing Israel on the settlements. He has gone further in Afghanistan. He has allowed people who committed torture to get away with it. No trials. Nobody's going on trial for committing torture, knowing that it was against the law. Guantanamo Bay is open. Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan is open. These are black hole prisons where not even the Red Cross can get in to find out what it is we are doing to the people we capture there. People who have never been given any kind of rights, are allowed due process. People who 10 years later we find out were completely innocent, but they've been in prison 10 years. Imagine what kind of people they are when they get out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, shepherds who are out in the wrong day in the wrong field who get captured and told their Al-Qaeda supporters and tortured in a black hole prison for 10 years who have done absolutely nothing. And then when they get out, you know what they become? They become anti-American activists.
Well, sure.
And Obama, by the way, is going. He is as rightist as Bush was on the vast majority of his policies. And where rightists are involved, he is even further. He's going a step further, and I can give you a very specific example if you would like.
Yeah, you better, because I'm getting a little.
It's worrisome. It's worrisome because people think that you know you're making it up. I'm not making
hope,
it up.
Hope and change. We can believe in. I mean, there's a lot of people, these same working class Blue Barn Posse members. Who come from Republican families, they voted for Obama thinking, my God, it's got to be better than Bush. And then the economy was collapsing while we were going to the polls. And I'm not going to just dwell on Emma Goldman, you know, voting changed, or if I can't, or what was the, I can't remember who said if voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, Professor Jennifer, people want hope, and they want change we can believe in, and it's such a letdown to hear you criticize Obama. And frankly, I'm with you on this, but it's like swallowing some very bitter medicine. It really is.
It is, and in a way, that's why I started out, and I should end, I think, also with hope. Because, as I said, I've been an activist for 31 years, and
mm-hmm.
the more I see, I have seen change in the makeup of groups of people who are really starting to be skeptical about what our successive governments and administrations are doing, not only overseas, but right here at home, and that's positive. People are starting to say, wait a minute, that isn't right. Why are we worse off than we were 10 years ago? There was a stimulus package. Great. It wasn't nearly enough. Now, listen.
Some people say it went to the wrong people. None of us got stimulus.
The people who screwed over the average American were bailed out. And then the average American who might just be having his or her home foreclosed on is completely screwed. Where do they go then? How are they supposed to keep down a job if they don't even have an address? You know, I don't think most people realize how bad it is. But that's why I'm saying, on the other hand, there is more activity in this country, people waking up and saying, this is not right. This is not right, and we can change it. We can. We've done it before, and we'll do it again. But
it's happening out here, Professor Jennifer. It's happening out here, Jennifer. It is, but it's a strange way. You know, some of it, and I know people, whoever is the left, I don't even know who that is anymore.
I don't
you know, but no, they're in a strange way, it's really been co-opted, bought off, and turned into its opposite. You know, people, you know, I'm going to use the word, you know, I know people out here who got fired up about the Tea Party, but then they're not in it anymore.
Well,
but
actually,
there was anger. There was some legitimate anger. I don't know how to.
One of the things that really upsets me is that some of the very legitimate anger that is out there has been channeled into the Tea Party, because the Tea Party hasn't got the answers. The Tea Party is doing what Bush was doing. He is trying to scare people into becoming even greater bigots and hypocrites than the Bush administration itself was. We don't need to be scared. We're the most powerful nation on earth and the most powerful nation in world history. Nobody threatens us. Nobody threatens the United States. It's absurd to think this. You know, we are a very powerful nation, and there are many, many ways that we could make huge changes, positive changes, right here in the United States domestically. First, just by cutting these outrageous defense budgets that are fueling wars and anti-Americanism abroad. That's one tiny step. What, are we afraid of Mexicans? Come on, Mexico? We're afraid of Mexico? I mean, listen to what the Tea Party people are saying. We occupied half of Mexico. Texas, New Mexico, that was Mexico. And those people who have nothing, they don't even have a shirt on their back, can't come over to this country and find a job picking berries. I mean, the Americans themselves won't do it. It's just crazy that we are feeding fear of these people. And this country hasn't got enough space. And if we want our economy back in shape, there are many, many, many things we can do about it that don't involve selling $460-some billion in weapons hardware to the most volatile place on Earth. It's just crazy.
Boy, so, I'm telling you, that's a great figure. I am glad you gave that. Made the whole show right there.
I'll send you the article.
It's not just $5 billion to Israel. It's $460 something.
I will send you the article because I have it. It was an article printed in the Financial Times, not in some left wing alternative magazine.
Right.
You know, and you know, this is I get my news from the same mainstream places other people get their news. But I learned how to read between the lines, and people have to do that. People have to understand that the Holder versus Humanitarian Law project that Barack Obama supported basically means that anybody in this country who talks to a member of a so-called terrorist organization, anyone who talks to a member of an organization that is terrorist, not about how they can join, that's totally not the point. If we talk to them about nonviolent conflict resolution, if we talk to them about human rights, we are considered giving material support to terrorists and can be put in prison for that. That's what Barack Obama is responsible for, and his Supreme Court nominee, Elena Kagan. It's called material support. If I sat down with a member of Hezbollah and started to tell him about nonviolent conflict resolution and about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I could be imprisoned for providing material support to a terrorist group. That's what Barack Obama's administration has done. And I challenge anybody who's listening to this show to find that that's not true, because it's true. And it's one of the many ways in which the Obama administration has moved further to the right on destroying American civil liberties than George Bush. It's frightening.
It is. And I was, you know, there was some documentary I picked up on. It's a new documentary that came out, and we're talking about nonviolent conflict resolution happening, I guess, in the Gaza, and it's some documentary, and I don't know the name of it, but, you know, is there a nonviolent movement for disarmament in Gaza and anywhere.
Well, here's something that most people don't know also. The vast majority of resistance in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip is nonviolent. The vast majority, the overwhelming majority of it, more than 75% of it is nonviolent, probably more than 80% of it is nonviolent. But you know what happens to the leaders of nonviolent demonstrations in the West Bank? They get put in prison. Some of them get killed. So when people say here, well, where are their Gandhis? Where are their Martin Luther Kings? Their Martin Luther Kings and their Gandhis exist too. And every time they try to get a foothold in power, they are either assassinated by helicopter gunships, detained without charges in prison, or kicked out of the country and not ever let back. And I know people in all three categories. I know people who've been murdered because for nothing, because they were nonviolent. And they were resisting an occupation that is illegal. Why should they be in prison for that?
Well, the only one I really know that I could understand was Rachel Corrie, and of course that's my national chauvinism coming out there. But you know, she was
if you're not studying this stuff every day, I don't know how most people will know it. It's just that the problem is that even the left-wing, the so-called left-wing and progressive news agencies haven't got their act together well enough to really counter what's coming from the right. If they did, and we could really challenge some of the things that we are being told, and again, I tell you, we are being, as a nation, we are being intimidated and frightened by our own leaders into believing that the Mexicans are going to take us over, God only knows what. I mean, if people stop being afraid and just use a little bit of reason for a bit, they'll start to realize what a hoax that is. You know, why are they trying to scare us into these policies? We're a nation of immigrants. We're supposed to be opening our gates to people who are downtrodden and oppressed, who don't have work and don't have, are not free of political persecution. How can we be sitting around talking about building a wall across the U.S.-Mexican border? It's already there. I mean, that's just insane.
Well, I want to ask you, in the best tradition of This Is Hell from Chicago, Chuck Mertz, have you been on that? Have you been on that radio show?
I doubt it.
Well,
I don't know. Is that a left or a right wing? I don't know.
Oh, it's left. Chomsky's on it. But it's Chuck Mertz, listeners. It's called This Is Hell, and it's hilarious. I model my show off of it. And Chuck Mertz is a great guy, and I got an inside line. I'm going to send him your way. I'm going to do my put on the other end and say, hey, you got to have Jennifer Lowenstein on your show. But I want to tell you, he has a tradition, and I call it, I've adopted the same tradition. It's a great radio show. And it's, I always leave my guests with a question from hell in Kansas. And I want one last question from hell in Kansas. Professor Jennifer Lowenstein, will you answer the question from hell in Kansas?
Sure. As a native Kansan, how could I resist?
Right on, sister. All right. What are you planning on, what are you working on now, and what are you planning on publishing in the near future on Counterpunch or anywhere, and where can we get a hold of you?
Well, I teach full-time, and that makes writing more difficult, but I am
founded
a humanitarian aid project that will be launched on November 29th. It's called the Chomsky Fund, and it's in memory of Carol Chomsky, Noam Chomsky's wife. And anyone who donates to that will be able to, they can say, it's humanitarian aid that goes to the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the refugee camps in Lebanon, or if they have another preference, they can say. And the website is www.chomskyfund.org. And it's mostly complete, but the official launch will be on November 29th. So that's one of the things I've worked on for a year now to put together. And, you know, it involves all kinds of legalities because we are a legal, nonprofit humanitarian aid organization. We're a charity. So, you know, nobody's profiting from this or anything like that.
Yeah.
Noam Chomsky is the president of the organization. That's one of the things I've been working on the most. Another project has been an essay on the arms buildup in the Arab world that the United States is fueling, and I'm about two-thirds of the way through an article on that I have to finish. But I'm also teaching a class on Introduction to the Modern Middle East, which I teach every semester at the University of Wisconsin. And, you know, I get about 100 students every term, and I find that my students are excellent students. They don't know very much coming in, but they're curious, they want to learn, and I just feel so good about teaching that class because I'm teaching them the history of a region that explains why we're in the messes we're in today. It's not that complicated. It really isn't. But it isn't taught very much. And it's the only course at the University of Wisconsin regularly taught on the Arab world. Figure that one. You know, we should be getting tons of these courses taught. But the point is, it's a small thing because it only reaches, you know, a small group of people, relatively speaking, every semester. But as I said, the students who take it are by and large people who, while they don't know that much when they come in, they really want to learn. And I give them all different perspectives. They say, you want to hear a right wing? This is what the right wing perspective would say. This is what the person on the right is going to tell you. This is what a person on the left is going to tell you. I use textbooks that are official, that are written by scholars at Oxford University. You know, I'm not up on a soapbox when I teach. I teach history. And, you know, it's just, it's sad to me because I think if every high school and every college or community college could incorporate a class like that, a required class like world history, only one that teaches you about the modern Middle East or Central Asia or Latin America, whatever, you know, people start to understand things that seem so complicated at first. And then they do some reading and, you know, you do a little bit of work and you find out, well, this is, a lot of this is pretty easy to figure out.
Well, you've been, when I read your stuff on Counterpunch, you've inspired me to think about this stuff. And I know some of my friends and buddies out here, men and women, brothers and sisters, we're I want to let you know, Jennifer, we're watching. And I appreciate you coming on I mean, I'm really happy to hear about this foundation. Consider coming back on after you get the thing up and running. And where's the address, the web address again, please?
It's www.chomskyfund, that's one word, chomskyfund.org. And as I said, anybody listening who goes to check it immediately will find that it is almost completed, but we're still finishing our links page. And the official launch will be on November 29th, which is the 63rd anniversary of the partition plan, the plan that divided Palestine. That's not really important for people to know. But there's a whole slideshow there of Gaza that is new. These are all my photographs taken literally a year ago, and they haven't changed because there's no building materials going into Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I hope that it picks up and that we're able to send funds over to human rights organizations and to schools and to health clinics and all kinds of different organizations that work for people, not for political parties. This is
be sure to send me
for the people.
Be sure, I'll try to get the link and put a perma link on my websites and at the Fight and Cock Flyer, the infamous irascible Fight and Cock Flyer, I will put a permalink up there. And
that's really great.
Thanks.
I
appreciate you coming on my show a lot. And you Skype listeners, you callers from Europe, I see you coming on, but you're not holding your hand up. But that's okay because we're running out of time. And I just want to thank you once again, Jennifer Lowenstein, for coming on Radio Free Kansas.
Thank you for having me. And just let me say one last thing.
Sure, of course.
There is always hope. Things are really bleak right now, but there is always hope. And if there wasn't, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing.
Well, I am so happy you've done it. I think you've given me some, you sort of, you know, tempered the steel here for me. I'll redouble my efforts out here.
Just remember, this is a Kansan speaking, proud Kansas native.
That's right.
I'm not kidding.
I know. I believe you, sister. I was so happy that we hooked up several years ago by email, and I'm really, really, really happy. What a great show. I appreciate you coming on, Jennifer. And after you get the foundation going, especially for Carol and Noam, I want to have you back on again, okay?
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, too.
Thank you. I hope it's been comfortable. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, sure.
All right, listeners, now I'm going to finish with something by the troubadour, David Rovix, and I'll move on to just a little bit of closing stuff, but I want you to enjoy some music from David Rovix, one of my favorite musicians, and Professor Jennifer is such a sweetheart. Oh, my goodness, I don't know how to. This is called Beyond the Barricades by David Rovix, which is free on the Internet if you go get it. I'll be back with
when
you.
When the world has gone crazy and it's all becoming clear, when they're gunning down our comrades, and it seems the end is near, as they're loading up the launchers for the tear gas grenades, we can take off our bandanas and kiss behind the barricades. When it's madness all around, and you can see this at a glance, we will sing and we will cry, we will laugh and we will dance. As they shout their marching orders beneath the helicopter blades, we shall seize the moment for a kiss behind the barricade. They will try to break our spirit, and at times they may succeed, but our love for the world is stronger than their greed. When the building is surrounded and hope begins to fade, in my final hour, a kiss behind the barricade. As the movement grows, there will be hills and bends, but at the center of the struggle are your lovers and your friends. And the more we hold each other up, the less we can be swayed. Here's to love and solidarity, and a kiss behind the barricade.
Back in the Depression, farmers held the line. When the bank came for an auction, together they'd combine. They knew that when divided, they could never win. But they stood shoulder to shoulder, didn't let the bankers in. They stood shoulder to shoulder, that's how they kept their farms. If one of them was threatened, it was for all to be alarmed. They said this was their land and they'd help each other stay. That's how they kept their farms, that's why the bankers went away. 'Cause the union makes us strong. The union makes us strong. Back in the Depression, there was not enough to eat. But the union of the unemployed was in the driver's seat. If the cops did an eviction, took the bed and put it out, the neighbors would carry it in, sing a song and shout. The union makes us strong. The union makes us strong. I can hear him talking, you've got to look at the long view. Back in the Depression, almost everybody knew competition was so great, why don't they do it with themselves? Instead of buying off the Congress and ruling by cartel, the union makes us strong. The union makes us strong. Thank you. People fought and won back then. Now the battle's global and it must be won again. They will try to divide us, but even on the darkest day, when I listen closely, I hear a billion people say, the union makes us strong. The union makes us strong. The union makes us strong. The union makes us strong.
This is Fred Whitehead, signing in again for Radio Free Kansas. Today's short reflection is a piece that I wrote in 1981 called The Philosophy of the Working Class. A few years ago, Professor Yuri Melville of the University of Moscow was addressing an American academic audience on the basic questions of philosophy, and I still recall vividly one of his most pointed remarks. Why did graduate students in American philosophy department spend so much time pondering whether and if and how did imaginary beings, such as fairies or trolls and the like, exist, and so little time considering questions of philosophy and ethics which seem to confront us every day in our lives? Then, somewhat later, more light was thrown on this question by a response that Lenin made to a speaker at a medical congress before the revolution. The speaker was taking up the subject of abortion, claiming that it was a good thing not to bring children into the world because there was so much suffering and unhappiness. Lenin's response was characteristically incisive. Here we have the basic difference between the psychology of the peasant, the artisan, and the intellectual of the petite bourgeoisie, generally, and the worker. The petite bourgeois feels that he is perishing, that life is becoming more difficult, the struggle for existence more intolerable, his situation and that of his family more and more hopeless. The class-conscious worker, Lenin continued, is far removed from such a point of view. He will not allow his consciousness to be obscured by such views, no matter how sincerely and feelingly they may be uttered. We, workers and small owners, too, lead an unbearable life filled with oppression and suffering. In one respect, we are better off than our parents. We have learned, and are learning fast, to struggle. We are fighting better than our fathers did. Our children will fight still better, and they will win. One of the main tenets of working-class philosophy is an emphasis on life itself, the necessity for survival in spite of great odds, and a sense of joy and pride in striving toward happiness. There is a beautiful passage of Yevtushenko's great poem, Bratsk Station, about the construction of a huge hydroelectric dam in Siberia, and a young worker named Nushka Bertova. After a difficult early life, she was orphaned by World War II, she becomes a concrete mixer on the construction project, falls in love with another worker who, however, deserts her after she becomes pregnant. Filled with anxiety, she has her baby, and as she is leaving the hospital, is greeted by a team of her workmates who have come to present her with flowers and to congratulate her. They all helped me as if they were my savings, and from that time on, I was always asked by the men from the assembly unit or by the painter smilingly, well, how is our little son? This innate sense of kindness and generosity seemed to me fundamental to workers' ethics, both under duress and capitalism and in the full flower of socialism. It is an expression of what the late communist poet Pablo Neruda called our duty to life. In our own American literary experience, there is a passage in a classic novel by Jack London entitled Martin Eden, in which the hero is a writer who comes from poverty and near starvation, then makes the big time only to realize that it is empty. One day he wanders into a park and toward a bricklayer's picnic where he recognizes some old pals of his. He had been to the working class picnics too often in his early life not to know what they were like, and as he entered the park he experienced a recrudescence of all the old sensations. After all, they were his kind, these working people. Martin drank with them and began to feel really human once more. He was a fool to have ever left them, he thought, and he was very certain that his sum of happiness would have been greater had he remained with them, and let alone the books and the people who sat in the high places. In the current bad times in the United States, which threaten soon to get much worse, we need to always remember our basic ethical principles, which will be as beacons in the darkness. It is obvious that few, if any, among the ruling class have such conceptions. And with the light of these principles, we can reveal them to be what they are.
Listeners, the new issue, issue number 65 of the Fightin' Cock Flyer Hard Gravel Road edition, will be coming out, and I'm proud to announce that Dr. Fred Whitehead will be on. There'll be a very interesting, thought-provoking article called Call to Act on the front of the broadsheet of the flyer. And if you want to get it, just come in and email us at Blue Barn News Central. That's all one word, bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com, and I'll send you a free copy as a file attachment, and you can get it and read it yourself. It'll be distributed in hard copy all across North Jefferson County and down in Lawrence and in Kansas City. We get it out all over the place. It's free, and real happy and proud to have featured Dr. Whitehead on the front. That's top center. Also, Mary Pitt from Anderson County will be on also in this next upcoming issue of the Fightin' Cock Flyer. And I want to extend my thanks to Professor Jennifer Lowenstein and to David Rovix for the music, and to Jim Herman, co-chair of the Kansas Progressive Caucus, which you'll find a link to at the flyer. I'll be putting that up later this weekend. You'll be able to check out the Kansas Progressive Caucus. Consider joining it. It's worth it. I'm in it, and I enjoy it, and I consider it's good people. It is an oasis of free thinking there on the right here in the middle of Kansas, and it gives you a breath of fresh air. And with that, I want to play a little bit of music from Jim Herman. He's a talented musician, and his buddies, his son, all of them are in the Hermanators, and I'm going to play a little bit of that and close the show. Thank you for listening in. I appreciate it. This is a song he wrote, and remember, folks, 5:30 on the Plaza, Kansas City, Missouri, this coming Monday. They'll be there, and they'll be politely asking Rainy Day Bookstore to put George Bush's book in the crime section. Here's Corporate Kings. I think you might enjoy this song. Thank you for listening. I'll be back and say goodbye.
The facts is reason Sam Adams and Revere are so big is something that history teachers often have missed. You see, the East India Company had debts to pay, so the king had been bottom and the poor away. Cornered the market on the colonist tea, giving East India a monopoly. When a group of patriots fought for this nation to set us all free from kings and corporations, Washington, Jefferson, Sam Adams, Revere made a stand for values and ideals. Listen, we the people, we have the power to take on all injustice and make it right. We the people, this is the hour. Set aside all difference, stand and fight. If history teaches anything, it's that we must resist corporate kings. Rockefeller, Carnegie Steel, American Tobacco, J.P. Morgan Rails, Randolph First, and the papers.
We'll be back on Monday night at 10 p.m. Central, USA time zone. Be sure and tune in if you want. Also, guessing on Wednesday, Monday night, maybe we'll hear from the Monday night, maybe we'll hear about activities up there at the Plaza in Kansas City, Missouri. If you're in the area, you ought to go there. 5:30 at the Plaza, George Bush Decision Points. Go out there and tell them. Put that book in the crime section in your bookstores, folks. Thank you for listening, and I enjoyed the show today. I especially enjoyed Professor Jennifer and the good news about the foundation for Carol Chomsky. What a great day. Enjoy your weekend. See you next Monday night, beginning at 10 p.m. Central. I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. Thank you for listening. And
once me lamb bricks and old Bill Brown took the load of corn to town, and old Jim Dobbs, the ornery cuss, he just naturally followed us. As we drove past Sam Johnson's store, past the apps came out the door. When Jim, he stopped to smell a box, they shied at him a bunch of rocks. Every time I come to town, the boys keep kicking my dog around. Makes no difference if he is their hound, they gotta quit kicking my dog.